Gary Stevenson is back on the Another Europe podcast, and this time he's got a new best-selling book, The Trading Game, to tell us about. It's not just a page-turner, it's a parable of the misogyny, greed and corruption that blights these crisis-ravaged times.
In that meeting one day, they said basically every major government in the world is effectively bankrupt. Thinking, okay, so all the people are bankrupt. All the governments are bankrupt. So who's got the money then? And obviously, I'm sitting on this desk surrounded by millionaires, right? And that was like the penny drop moment for me, where you're like, this is it, this is it, this is what's happening, isn't it? It's, we're losing the middle class losing their homes, government's going bankrupt, and it's going to the rich, and then... And that's not going to stop, is it? That's only going to keep going. So here you go.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host, Zoe Williams. Our guest on today's show is former City of London foreign exchange trader, Gary Stevenson. He made millions following the financial crisis, and it made him realise the system is rigged against working class people. He even calls it organised bank robbery in his new book. It's already a Sunday Times bestseller. Perhaps, like me, you've spotted people reading it on public transport. Now, this isn't the first time we've spoken to Gary. Regular listeners will know that we originally touched base with him back in episode 62, when we first heard his remarkable story. We checked in with him again in episode 88, when we picked his brains about the cost of living crisis. We don't actually retread much of that ground in this podcast. If you like what you hear today, then do go back and check out the Another Europe archive. For more from Gary, do subscribe to his brilliant YouTube channel with everything you need to know about the economics of these crazy times.
Hi, this is Seema. I joined Another Europe is Possible in 2018. For me, the most important thing about this space is building a transnational movement for a more democratic economy, anti-racist politics, and global solidarity beyond nationalism. So that's why I hope you join the Another Europe is Possible family too. Go to anothereurope.org/join and sign up to get access to an extended version of this podcast.
Hi, Gary, welcome back to the podcast. Huge congratulations on the book. It's really struck a chord and it's already selling really well. Did you expect that, or did you think it was going to be a bit more niche?
If I'm being totally honest, I thought it would do pretty well. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that. It's just funny, people might not realise, I don't know if you've written a book, but you know, I finished this book back last year in March, and there's a massive gap between when the author finishes the book and when it publishes. So I've been sort of sitting on this for a year, and I'd never planned to write a book, but I got a call from the guy who's now my agent, maybe about 3 years ago, saying, you should think about writing a book. And I just told him to get lost, basically, because it seemed like a lot of work. And I started sort of like stabbing at it, like trying bits and bobs. I had a very clear picture of what I wanted to write, which was very like first person experiential, what life is actually like on the trading floor, kind of the anti-Wolf of Wall Street. I wanted you to really like feel like you were there. And I poked around that a bit and I gave up for a while because I couldn't get the structure right. And then I got another call maybe about 9 months later from an editor at a small publishing house. And she convinced me to send her a little bit of what I'd written. And then they tried to sign me straight away, basically. Then I went back and read it and I thought, actually, this is quite cool. If I can just figure out the shape of it, we might have something really good here. I wrote 20,000 words, which is the whole of what is now part one. There's five parts of the book. We sent that off and there was just a massive bidding war for all the publishers for it. And that's when I realized, if I get this right, we might have the chance of something big on our hands.
Fantastic. And the book at times feels like almost a work of sociology, like it's full of participant observation, as the anthropologists would call it. And you move through like several different worlds when you're telling this story, from working class East London to the cosmopolitan hub of the London School of Economics, dear to my heart, the City of London, and of course, you know, this new world of the super rich. And funnily enough, I think that there is aside to the LSE that you didn't come across as a student, and reflects the way that people live side by side with one another in these completely different worlds. If you had studied anthropology or gender studies, you would have got, I think, a different sense of what the LSE was like. And I'm just wondering, were you conscious when you were writing the book that this kind of is a work of sociology by a former city trader? You even used the word sociological at one point, I think, to describe the kind of observations that you're making about people.
Well, I'm not an expert on sociology. I did sociology A-level back in my teenage years. I wanted it to be very first person. I didn't want to do any like abstracted analysis. I really wanted you to feel what I felt at the time. And I wanted you to sort of, well, I hope that you would reach some of the same conclusions that I reached, but not because I'm telling you what to believe, but because you're seeing the things that I'm seeing and you're meeting the people that I'm meeting. I wanted it to be like really character driven, because I think like purely from the perspective of a book, the guys that I worked with on the trading floor especially, but you know, even things like my experience at LSE, these are such crazy places full of such crazy people that I think you can learn so much more from just seeing what I saw than anything I can sort of tell you to believe. I wanted to do something a little bit like, have you read Candide by Voltaire?
I have. Yeah.
You know, that book is, you know, obviously it's a very old book by an old French philosopher, but he's challenging an idea about society, which is that, you know, society has to be this way because if it wasn't this way, God wouldn't have made it this way. And rather than telling you like that's a stupid idea, which I personally would argue it probably is, he shows you what's happening in the world, shows you the horrors of the world. And he just asks you to come to your own conclusions. Like, do you think this is right? So I actually, often at times in the book, I pretend to buy in to this world, maybe a bit more than I really do, maybe a bit more than I even really did at the time. Because I kind of want to challenge you as the reader to think about, what do you think about a world like this? What do you think about a world where a 22-year-old kid can get paid £500,000 while his dad's struggling to pay the bills? What do you think about that? What do you think about a world where people make millions of pounds betting on the collapse of society? So I suppose now with my relatively limited knowledge of sociology, I would say that there is a sociological analysis, but it's also kind of a dramatic game and a literary game. It's more sort of, it's a challenge. But I guess, you know, I guess even fiction can be sociological analysis, I would say.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Absolutely.
Luke is really into this misogyny question.
Okay.
And for the general listener, has framed it as there are lots of very misogynistic moments in the book, which I guess I would agree with. You know, there's a bit where Gary's boss asks him to kind of flick through the pages of Sports Illustrated, looking at women in bikinis. But I didn't really read that as misogyny. I read it more as a kind of profound social weirdness of that interchange. You know, the kind of, are you one of the guys? But even I don't understand what a guy is or what one of the guys is. Parking that for a second, there's another moment where a trader is trying to figure out how to sire a male child with positions. I wasn't struck by the misogyny. What I was struck by was the complete absence of women, like a complete lacuna where any women would have been. There's Stephanie at the very beginning who kind of shows you the desk. And after that, there is no female presence. And there's also this hyper-masculinist identification where, you know, any show of feeling is disgusting. Any show of loyalty is disgusting, but loyalties are there. And allied to that, you know, risk being something a man should be able to take, but loss being something a man shouldn't have to even countenance. I mean, I wonder whether, I don't know whether this is sort of like a bit of a wishy-washy question, but do you think if there were more women involved in the architecture of financialization, it just wouldn't have ended up like this?
Yeah, I'm glad to your characterization, because the way you've taken is basically exactly what I was intending to show, which is exactly as you say, rather than a misogynistic space, it is a space in which there is basically a complete absence of women. I wanted to capture this sense of, have you seen, I can't remember if it's the last scene of The Godfather or Godfather Part 2, where Michael Corleone, Al Pacino, is in there with his advisors, who are of course both men, and his wife is outside holding the kids by the hand saying, come, you know, see the kids, and the doors close on his wife. I wanted to give this kind of sense that it's, I mean, it probably is a misogynistic space if you dig in and sort of ask people what's going on, but it's just a phenomenally male space with a complete absence of women. And I'm glad you mention Stephanie, because Stephanie is one of, there's only, I think, perhaps two women in the book who are given real names, which is, there's another Japanese one briefly mentioned at the end called Mickey. But that was very intentional. And what I wanted to do with that is give you a sense of men who are so absorbed in this game and so absorbed in this masculine world that
they completely almost eliminate women from their lives. And of course, they'll have wives back home who are sort of doing, you know, taking care of the kids, or perhaps taking care of the nanny to take care of the kids. One thing that I find quite interesting is we've obviously moved into a less gendered society over the last sort of 50 years in terms of ordinary people's lives. You know, we no longer have, in most families, the man working and the woman staying home doing the housework. But then once you enter these elite societies, they are still in that gendered space. It's really, once you go towards like extremely wealthy men, I've never been at sort of top level journalism, but I suspect you'll see it at the top level of every industry. What you find is men who still live these lives, which have the gender roles of 100 years ago. And the women are sort of locked away and sort of hidden.
Yeah, I find that really fascinating, because actually there's a kind of sense of separation with the way you describe yourself and Harry as well from women. You know, there's this kind of complete disembodiment of what would be a normal, typical young experience. And it feeds into that really pressing sense that the game has to be won, but life outside it is kind of grey and two-dimensional.
I think the way that these men treat women, and, you know, we could talk about traders, but to be honest, I think this is probably true of a lot of very wealthy society, what you might want to call elite society. The way they treat women is very much in a line with the way they emotionally collapse themselves. I think that they've created this world, which it is hyper-masculine, but it's also extremely emotionally collapsed. And they make themselves these one-dimensional figures, which is their whole idea is that they should be strong and that they should make money and that they should compete. It's a very simplistic idea. And they completely collapse their emotional selves. And I think what I wanted to do, I wanted to show you, there's little moments. When I read the audiobook, I went back and some points were quite hard to read. And the points which I found hardest to read were the points at which the traders show each other kindness. And the reason I found those hard to read is because I think in those little moments, you see that these people are humans and they actually want something different. They want to be able to relate to each other. They want to be able to connect to each other. You see these moments like when Billy's drunk and he starts crying to me, these kinds of things. Or when Chuck tells us about his sickness and you kind of see these moments of physicality. Or even some of the scenes where these guys are fighting with each other. There's kind of a need to connect. And I think that they want more, but they've been trained. They've been trained to completely emotionally isolate themselves. And of course, that includes me as much as others. And obviously, towards the latter end of the book, you get the introduction of Wizard, who's kind of trying to sort of pull me back to being a human again, in a sense. But I've been so powerfully trained that it's my job to be strong and to be independent and to not have any emotional needs, that I'm very resistant to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we agree, don't we, really, in terms of the relationship between masculinity and arguably misogyny in this space that you describe. There's this argument that sociologists sometimes make that I thought was very resonant to some of the scenes described in the book, which is basically that some of the principal victims of the concept of hyper-masculinity or violent masculinity are men. And so there's various examples of this at work in the stories that you tell. One quite good example is when there's a particular colleague of yours, I can't remember his name now, but he's blind drunk and he's drinking with the brokers. And this guy is described as intensely lonely. He only goes out with his workmates and with the brokers, and he's obsessed with making money. And the brokers are in this inferior asymmetric power relation to the traders. And at one point you describe him kicking the broker, shouting something to the effect of, "Take me out and get me drunk, broker scum," or something like this, like a really intense masculinity moment. And you're thinking, God, this is really quite a sad world that has been created by money. So your points then about what does empathy and what does happiness mean in this super sad and at times quite desperate world, I think are really apt. Would you say that this is another story, but one that's based on fact of, you know, the old idea that money doesn't make you happy and there's a kind of loneliness that's fundamental to the lives that your ex-colleagues were leading?
Yeah, I think there's a quote, I used to think it was by Shakespeare, but it's not, it's a contemporary. It says, "Ambition is a great man's madness." This space, trading floor, it's very, very difficult to get that job. Obviously, it's easy if you're from a very rich background, but it's still not easy for anyone to get that job. You have to make a lot of sacrifices and be extremely ambitious to be able to get into that space. And we exist in a society which I think kind of lionizes ambition as a personality trait. Definitely, I got that sense when I was a young man. But then I think when you look at the most ambitious people in our society, and, you know, following the pot, I mean, I was unbelievably ambitious as a young man. I guess I'm still quite ambitious now. When you look at the most ambitious people, I think that they're trying to fill up some kind of gap most of the time. And then, you know, you mentioned this character. It was Spengler who, you know, used to demand the brokers take him out. And he used to sort of go out and try and get laid. Right? But the only reason he would try and get laid is so he could tell embarrassing stories about himself and that experience to the traders on the desk. This really, really bizarre kind of like sort of second level attempt to get sort of affection. His mum would call him up every evening at three o'clock in the afternoon. His mum would call him up from the country he was from and speak to him in their native language. I had to change both his nationality and the language for legal reasons. But he was such a great character because he really shows you these hyper-masculine people just craving affection and struggling to get affection. And I think the big picture I was trying to tell you is these ambitious people, why do they do it? They tell themselves often, I do it for my wife, I do it for my kids. But then you've obviously got this Caleb character. So Caleb is my boss who first hired me. And he quits like partway through the book. And he achieves this idea we have, which is people who try and make money, they do it because they want to create a perfect life for their family. And he quits and he goes and he makes his perfect life, this perfect family. He builds the perfect house in Northern California for his family. And then a few years later, he comes back. And there's this question of why. Everyone's always making a ton of money saying, I'm going to leave next year. I'm going to leave next year. I'm going to leave next year. And I think, in a sense, what I'm trying to do for you and hopefully for any young people who read the book is kind of ask that deeper question of why are we so obsessed with money? And I suppose answer this obvious question, which you ask in a sense, which does it ever make us happy? I mean, for me, I had the experience of growing up very poor and then working with these very wealthy people. And I think it was really painfully obvious to me that all of these guys were less happy than my dad, you know? So I know it sounds cliche to say it, and maybe people say it's easy for you to say once you've made money, but I've seen a lot of people make a lot of money and very rarely did it make them happy.
Yeah, interesting. And there's a couple of points in the book that are quite poignant in terms of your personal experience. You talk about your relationship with your first girlfriend lasting a few months after you made your first big bonus, and your relationship with your friends that you grew up with never quite being the same again. Do you still feel like that now? Or
it's funny, I think, you know, I had my book launch last month. It only came out last month, and you invite all your friends and your family, and then Penguin, they said to me, oh, you know, you can invite 60 people. And I remember thinking, I don't even think I know 60 people. but then like, you go out and you invite them around, and, you know, we had more than 100 people come in the end. You know, they let me like expand it. And I think it makes you sort of start to question yourself how much, when I was a young person, I felt very alone. It sort of makes you question how much of that was reality and how much of that was a story I told myself and how much of that was something that I did to myself in a sense. And I think how much of that is something that naturally occurs from an obsession with making money. I think an obsession with making money is it's obviously a very self-centered obsession, you know. And I think when I was younger, I had you know, you guys, you've read the book, so, you know, you can see. I was mad when I was a kid. I was so unbelievably single-mindedly obsessed with this idea, like, I'm going to make it. I'm not going to let anybody stop me. That as soon as anybody crossed me or even sort of questioned what I was doing, I would just cut them out of my life. I think for me, you know, I'm older now and I've had time to sort of analyze it. I think there's one degree to which we've created this world which is unbelievably hostile to poor people. When you create this world, I don't think you can be surprised when young people from poor backgrounds become obsessed with money.
Just to cut in for a second, I was really struck by that bit at the very beginning where you kind of first realise that rich people think poor people are stupid. It's vitally important, you know. I'm really rooting for you all the way through to make all the money in the world, just to make that fucking point that, yeah. That like, the society is going along with this absolutely stupid presumption, which any amount of observation could disprove in a second. And it deserves to be brought down. It deserves to be hoodwinked. It deserves to be beaten. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but it creates this sort of game in my head. And there's one scene which I really like, which sort of addresses this, which is the scene after I make my first big bonus, which I'd been led to believe was going to be like £100,000 and turns up being nearly £400,000. And I'm literally in shock. I mean, I've just turned 23 years old. I'm a very young man and I'm sitting on the grass in Canary Wharf, you know, by myself, just thinking this through. And then, you know, I think about my dad, how hard my dad used to work. You know, my dad used to wake up at like 5 a.m. and take the train that went past the back of the house every morning, early in the morning. And I would sort of, my mum would wake me up and try and sort of get me to wave at my dad as he went past, you know, leaving early, getting back late every day for 20 grand a year. And here's me made, you know, nearly 400 grand when I've just turned 23 for basically playing a computer game. And you think of your friends' dads, you know, I grew up in this very immigrant area. My primary school had a lot of kids whose families had just come over from Pakistan, living like 7 people in a small house, sleeping on the sofa. And there's this scene where I start to think, well, why should they make it and not us? You know, why should they make it and not me and not Ibran and not Muzamil and not my dad? Why is it them? And I think what you see here is this kind of, there's two things going on, which is one, exactly what you say, Zoe, this idea, which is we deserve a seat at the table. But there's this other part, which is basically me being young and being greedy and wanting to be rich. And I think there's this kind of, there's this interplay between the two things. And I still to this day, I'm not really sure where I stand on it, because people, you know, like to point at me and say, you're rich, you know. These guys pointing at me are probably richer than me. You know, I went on a show with Melanie Phillips and she pointed at me and said, why haven't you given all your money away? She's definitely richer than me, right? But because I come from a poor background, I'm expected to give all my money away. Whereas her and her family can be rich forever just because, you know, they've got some wealthy ancestors. But at the same time, there's another scene later in the book where, you know, Harry Sambi is a friend of mine who I grew up with. And I end up becoming kind of like a surrogate dad to him because his mum passes away and I get him into the city. And there's this one scene where he shouts at me and he says, what do you do it for? You say you do it for Ilford. You never even go to Ilford. You never go to the football with your dad. You never even go speak to your mum. You never see your mates anymore. What is it for? And I think on the one hand, I am proud that I did what I did coming from where I come from. And I still talk how I always talked and I still dress how I always dressed. But I think there's another part which was motivated by greed. And it's the problem you have in this world that we live in, which is increasingly very unequal, is every single one of us as an individual has to land somewhere on the scale of being poor or being separated from humanity. And, you know, I was forced to make that decision. And there's no real good answer. I don't think anybody who's come from a poor background and has made money, which, to be honest, is increasingly fewer and fewer people in the world that we live in, will not have had to deal with these questions somewhere in your heart, which is, to what degree am I justified in taking my family out of poverty? And to what degree do I have a responsibility to the people I've left behind?
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we've definitely covered and extensively and in a beautiful way that you have written a work of sociology.
Okay.
So let's actually move on now to what you've really been emphasising. And on the two previous pods we did with you too, like since you've left the city, it's your revolutionary critique of the economic system. You know, at the core of the book is this basic idea that the system is rigged against working class people, as you've just explained. So how investment bankers can take these massive risks and how the state will always bail them out for fear of the entire economic order collapsing. So I think that does that lead to this kind of problem of enormity? I mean, as I said, it's an almost revolutionary critique in reformist times. So let's take a moment to talk about your critique of the system and what steps we can do to make it better.
So my background is mathematics, right? And well, maths and economics undergrad at London School of Economics before I worked in the city. And since then, I've done 2 years at Oxford doing economics masters. So, you know, I know how economics is supposed to work. There's not much focus on distribution when you study economics. And I worked as a trader for many years, which is basically the story of this book. About halfway through the book, I come to this realization, which we sort of build up to it. I start thinking about things more and more, which is that basically we fundamentally misdiagnose what's happening in the economy in the aftermath of 2008. I think it's still true now, which is economists are kind of focused on efficiency and then they keep saying there's a string of efficiency problems. But there's a really big underlying problem, which nobody seems to have realized, which is there's a really massive transfer of wealth going on within society. And that is that the middle class are essentially losing their wealth. The main way to see that is that home ownership rates are collapsing for young people, mortgage sizes are exploding. At the same time, government is massively losing its wealth. Basically the same things, government losing its assets, enormous increase in government debt. And that all of this wealth is not disappearing. It is simply transferring to a very small group of very rich people. And once you realize that that's happened, you should be able to quite quickly realize that it won't fix itself, right? Because if the middle class can't run a balanced budget when they own their own home, then they definitely can't when they don't own their own home. And if the government can't run a balanced budget when it's not enormously in debt to the rich, then it definitely can't when it is enormously in debt to the rich. And if the rich were able to completely dispossess the middle class before they had a massive increase in their wealth, they definitely can now they're much, much, much richer. So what I saw was basically the end of sort of middle class Western economy. We were going to move towards a very highly unequal economy, that would lead to permanently collapsing living standards. To be honest, definitely when I sort of first concluded this in 2011, nobody was saying it. We just had Piketty coming out around about that time. So I start betting that we would never get an economic recovery. By the end of 2011, I'm Citibank's most profitable trader in the world. I make a ton of money. You sort of see in the back end of the book me sort of trying to rack my brains about like, what does that mean if society's going to collapse forever? And basically, I think that if you don't control the ability of the rich to dispossess the less rich and the relatively weak, which in our society is the middle class and the government, then they will dispossess them and they are dispossessing them. And I think there's a massive black hole in the discussion about this. And I think nothing highlights this more than the economic mismanagement of COVID. So from the very beginning of COVID, we knew there was going to be a massive government deficit. And to this day, the total government deficit since the beginning of COVID is £800 billion, which would be enough to give every single adult in the country £16,000 each. The amount in the US is $10 trillion, by the way, which is $80,000 per taxpayer, 80. So we know this huge amounts of money is going out. Really, really, really obviously, everybody should have been asking, if the government's going to give away a huge amount of money, who's going to get massively richer? And, you know, I did the analysis. You know, people can listen to our earlier podcast. They can watch my first video on my YouTube channel, How the Rich Get Rich from COVID-19. If anyone bothered to do the analysis, it would have been extremely obvious that COVID was going to lead to an absolutely enormous transfer of wealth from the government to the very rich. And if I were to ask you guys now, what do you think would happen if we paused the economy for 2 years and in that time transferred an unbelievably enormous amount of money from the government to the rich? What do you think would happen to living standards? You would obviously say broad living standards will fall, government services will fall, and rich living standards will increase. But nobody had this discussion at the time. I honestly think I've never seen anything more amazing and beautiful in a sublime sense to the fact that nobody in society managed to mention this. It's just unbelievable. It's like somebody came and set your house on fire and you didn't even mention it to anyone. This transfer of wealth is so enormous. And the reason for this is because there's just a massive black hole in the way economists think about the economy. They simply do not think about distribution because that was what they've been taught at universities. The transfer in wealth from the government to the rich in the last 5 years is so unbelievably big that it will obviously impoverish our society. And it has happened basically without comment from anyone. Until you fix this, then the future is basically disaster and collapse of living standards. And we will end up looking like Brazil or looking like India or looking like South Africa. We will end up looking like the very unequal economies of the world because we are becoming a very unequal economy. And those economies have extremely wealthy elites that live extremely luxurious living standards in palaces surrounded by barbed wire, and the rest of us basically live extremely impoverished lives. And that's what happens if you don't protect the wealth distribution.
And do you think like the narrative has moved in your direction on this though, since the couple of podcasts that we've done? I mean, you know, look at the Biden administration in the United States. He now says in not quite as radical terms as Gary Stevenson, but he does frequently say trickle-down economics doesn't work. But there seems to be an inability to turn that into a policy program that actually addresses the problem that he identifies. Would you agree with that?
I think in some ways, yes. In some ways, no. You know, a lot of people are campaigning for higher taxation of the rich. I think that public opinion is definitely shifting towards taxation of the rich. I think that there is, to a degree, a growing understanding that our problems are connected to the growing wealth of the rich. But if you look at policy, and to be honest, I've, you know, now I'm in a bunch of sort of WhatsApp groups with like, you know, leftist economists and people who have influence on policy, I've had phenomenally little success in trying to get people on the left on board with the idea that you need to tax rich people more. I've been amazed at my inability to do that. And, you know, even if you look at, I mean, you know, we don't need to say the incoming Labour government is very clear that they do not want to raise tax on rich people. If you look at what Biden's done, I think their policy is better. They've spent a lot more money, but it's borrowing from the rich. They're not increasing taxes on the rich. They haven't increased taxation on the rich. And I don't think it will succeed. I think it's better than what we're doing. I think we're starting to win public opinion, but, you know, there's nowhere in the world that is really significantly talking about taxation of the rich. And I think it will fail. I think if you have a group of people who are extremely powerful and are aggressively dispossessing you, until you stop them dispossessing you, you will continue to become poorer. Nobody's grasping the nettle. You cannot fix this without significantly increasing taxes on rich people. And, you know, I think this is because political parties are funded by rich people, to be honest, quite simply. But, you know, I would expect there to be more unanimity on outriders on the left. But the truth is, the reason I'm able to say what I say, Luke, is because I'm a rich person and I fund myself. And the other people who speak about the left, very few of them are self-funding. And if you look at where the money comes from, if they work for a think tank, if they work for the media, ultimately, at the end of the day, most of the money comes from rich people. And that is the problem we have. And that is why I sort of consciously decided to stop writing for The Guardian and to make a YouTube channel instead. Because I don't think we're going to fix this by asking rich people to tax themselves. I think we are only going to fix this when ordinary people who increasingly can't simultaneously feed their kids and turn the heating on, stop accepting it.
And do you think taxation is of itself enough of an answer? You know, you've got people like Ann Pettifer saying the entire structure of financial markets has to be, she doesn't even say brought to heel anymore, she says destroyed. Do you think the kind of systemic business of how we use money has to be kind of taken apart at the seams?
I honestly think if you were to do a one-off enormous tax on rich people and burn the money, you would see a significant improvement in living standards. Honestly, to be as simple and clear as possible. Because if you did that, you would basically be reversing what we did in COVID. In COVID, what we did was a one-off printing of an enormous amount of money, which it went through the pockets of poor people, but it ended up in the pockets of rich people. And if people want to know exactly how that works, they should just go and watch my first video, How the Rich Get Rich from COVID-19, or read the articles I wrote for Open Democracy in 2020. The thing you need to understand is, money is not real resources, okay? Money is a distributional resource. Money is a competitive resource. Money is the resource that we use to determine the allocation and distribution of the real resources. If you give a ton of money to one group, then they will use that money to buy the assets of other groups and to outcompete the other groups for resources that they need. Now, what happened in COVID was really amazing because every ordinary family accumulated like $2,000 and felt rich. And every rich family accumulated like £1 million. And then immediately afterwards, the rich massively increased their consumption and ordinary families didn't understand why they became poor. It's because you exist in a state of competition with the rich. You know, I cannot emphasize this enough. And listen, other people, Ann Pettifer, I'm sure she has some merit in her criticism of the financial system. And, you know, if you read my book, you'll see I'm critical of the financial system. You cannot allow the rich to take all of your assets and expect not to be poor. I know it's unfashionable, but you have to fight that distributional fight. If there is a group of people who are taking all of your stuff, if you do not stop them taking all of your stuff, they will take all of your stuff and you will be poor. And, you know, I think the problem is what you see is me and different people saying different things. Various parts of the economy are collapsing. What I can tell you with certainty, if you do not stop my part from collapsing, your grandkids' lives will be horribly poor. And, you know, Ann Pettifer is probably right in what she says. And of course, there'll be people out there saying, if you don't stop climate change, your kids' lives will be terrible. All I can tell you is the bit I know about. If you do not stop the rich taking everything, then it's going to be an absolute disaster in the future.
Yeah, and how do you go about doing that then, if we stick with this idea? Because I suppose if you're thinking about the distribution of economic resources, one way in which economic, and the primary way that you're talking about economic resources are distributed is through class relations in that sense. And then, but another way, of course, is that they're geographically distributed among states. And how does that feed in to your argument? So, for example, if the UK unilaterally introduced the one-off super tax on the rich to some kind of enormous degree on the scale that you're talking about, what would rich people do with their money? Would they try to respond to that geopolitically, in effect, by moving it to another economy. How would you respond to that argument?
So I think the first thing to say is to be clear, because sometimes people do misunderstand what I say. When I say tax the rich, I'm not talking about doctors or lawyers or, you know, heaven forbid, possibly even bankers. If you work for your money, you are not really rich. Rich people, work is not a significant source of income for them. They own an enormous amount of assets. You know, Rishi Sunak, according to the Sunday Times, worth £700 million. That means he'll make a passive income of 30, 40 million pounds a year from the assets that he owns. These are the guys that we need to tax. People with enormous amounts of assets. You have to catch these guys. And the reason you have to catch them is because once you have such a large amount of passive income, it becomes impossible to spend even a small percentage of that income. And you basically have no choice but to buy the rest of the assets. So these people will basically eat the middle class by default. So this is not about, you know, there'll be people out there who are accountants and lawyers who are terrified of me and you hate me. It's not about you, accountants and lawyers, maybe even bankers. We could be mates. It's about families that have enormous amounts of wealth that are accumulating all the rest of the wealth. It's about taxing very wealthy individuals. And this makes it clearer that actually it's not as easy for these guys to leave as they say it is. You know, you guys work for your money. If you wanted to go and work from Dubai, if you wanted to go and work from Singapore, you could go and work from these places. Rich people own assets. They own assets. They own your house. They own your mortgage. They own the government debt. They own businesses which are located in this country or sell to this country. These guys are actually not particularly financially mobile. I think the big example of that was when the government finally decided we want to tax Roman Abramovich, it suddenly transpired that it's actually quite easy to tax billionaires because what they own is massive corporations and businesses. And in the case of Roman Abramovich, an enormous football club in South London. And it's not easy to put that into a bag and take it to the Cayman Islands. So I think these people are taxable, but I also think people are right when they are concerned that when I say tax rich people, the rich people will find loopholes to avoid the tax and the tax will fall in the middle class. They're right to be concerned about that. Because I always remember when the Conservative government brought in their new tax on second home buyers, extra stamp duty for second home buyers. And when you looked into the details, there was a loophole in there for people who bought seven or more properties at once. And who went and immediately bought seven properties at one go? Our now Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt. So I think we definitely have a problem where there is an incentive for governments who are increasingly led by very rich people to promise taxes on the rich and to secretly put in loopholes that help them and their mates so that the very rich can avoid it. The most important thing is that you catch the people at the top. You absolutely have to catch the people at the top. Because if you do not catch the people at the top, their wealth share will continue to grow exponentially, which it already is. They'll become more and more powerful and they will have no choice but to eat the middle class. You have to catch the people at the top. With regards to whether the UK could do it independently or whether we would need international coordination, it would definitely be much easier with international coordination. I think if you look at the way things are shaping up internationally, first thing to say is this problem of falling living standards is not UK specific. It's happening everywhere. This problem of growing wealth inequality is not UK specific. It's happening everywhere. I think as much as I would love for it to be the case, I don't think we are the world leaders on taxing the wealth. I think we are unlikely to end up having to do it independently. If you look at the last time we significantly reduced wealth inequality, it happened across Europe and the US and the Western world all at once. I think it's about winning the battle for hearts and minds. And I think we can build that international solidarity on it because people across the West are seeing their living standards collapse and everybody wants to stop that.
I mean, I know I always say this, but I feel very optimistic listening to you because I think really what's hollowed out is not just the kind of assets and wealth share of the middle class and the working class, but also a kind of sense of possibility. And I don't know how much of that is about billionaire capture of the media landscape. And I don't know how much of it is just about a kind of perception of stasis when actually there's been a lot of change. But I kind of feel like that's in reverse a little bit.
People get confused. People just get told, oh, there's collapsing productivity and we need to deal with productivity and investment and growth. And they get all these economic buzzwords thrown at them, which are increasingly meaningless. They're just ways of politicians trying to sound like they're business friendly. I think if you understand that the root of the problem is a transfer of wealth and that the wealth has not disappeared, you realize that if we change our taxation system, we can transfer that wealth back. You know, we don't have to accept continually falling living standards. We exist in this kind of paradoxical economy where the government goes further and further into debt, seemingly to nobody. We never question where that debt has gone. The middle class loses its assets more and more, seemingly to nobody. We never question where those assets have gone. The rich have kind of very much silently dispossessed us and left us looking around at each other, asking, why are we poor now? The wealth is still there. And I think technology gets better and better, and we living standards get worse and worse. And it doesn't have to be that way. And it wasn't always that way. But I think it inevitably will be that way if you lose track of your wealth distribution. If you look back throughout history, most of history is phenomenally unequal societies and phenomenally low living standards for the majority and a tiny elite. We had 70 years where we decided to really significantly tax rich people. And in those 70 years, people like my dad and my friend's dads coming over from Pakistan could work low paid jobs and buy houses and have families. That is what is possible when you manage your wealth distribution and make the very rich pay their fair share of tax. And we did it before and we can do it again.
So Gary, since you've left the trading floor, you've entered another world. And after a few years, there was a break, of course, that we've talked about before. And it's a world of what you might call like left-wing commentators, media outlets, some Navarras of this world, campaigning organisations. I was wondering, after you've written such a great work of sociology, what do you make of this world? It's quite culturally different. It has its own meanings and ideas. It's another very different set of spaces to the ones that you encountered in the journey that got you here. What do you make of it, and where do you think the WhatsApp group of left-wing economists are going right or wrong?
Yeah, it's such a big space, isn't it? There's such a lot going on. What is weird is, I mean, I don't want to overgeneralize because the left is a massive, massive space with lots of like spaces within it. But the bits I've sort of floated around, media, sort of the economic left, think tanks. What is quite interesting is that it feels a much more culturally middle class space than the trading floor. The trading floor is full of rich people, definitely, but it's much more international. I suppose it's a little bit like I studied at LSE and I studied at Oxford. And what you see there is the average student at LSE is probably richer than the average student at Oxford because they're international money. But it's a kind of a money-focused, ambition-focused, cultureless space, which actually makes it weirdly more meritocratic because you don't have to face this kind of cultural judgment, cultural prejudice. Whereas Oxford was much more like dripping in these historic cultural ideas, you know, kind of British aristocracy cultural ideas. You know, on the trading floor, I could walk in as a nobody from Ilford, which is a nothing place in East London, and become like really respected and really well known and really quite famous simply for being right very often, having a really good track record for being right. And it doesn't matter if you're a complete dickhead, you really get respected for being right. And it was quite interesting what happened like during COVID, because during COVID, what we got was a massive government deficit spend, right? I did the analysis early on and I could see this money would all end up with the rich. And I was very confident that that would lead to like a massive disaster of living standards. And I was very outspoken early on in COVID, you know, living standards will collapse, inequality will go through the roof, house prices will explode, stock prices will explode, there'll be an explosion in inflation. And it actually made me weirdly quite divisive on the left. And I didn't realize it was going to do that, but I see now why it did. And that is because that came in 2020 after kind of 12 years where the left had become, in an economic sense, defined by opposition to austerity and had kind of gotten itself married to the idea what we want is more deficit spending. So when we got into COVID and what we got was an enormous surge of deficit spending and it didn't cause an immediate economic disaster, although I would argue it did cause an economic disaster after reopening, a lot of people on the left were quite happy, right? Because they felt that they'd been justified in what they were saying, which is we want a massive government deficit and we think it would be good for the economy. When we reopened and basically every single thing I predicted happened, I was sort of screaming, listen, guys, this is what happens when you give hundreds of billion pounds to rich people. I encountered a phenomenal amount of resistance because people were very married to this idea that what we want is deficit spending. And I would say to people, but, you know, this is exactly what I said would happen at the beginning of COVID and none of you were saying it and every single thing I predicted was right. And they would turn around to me and they would say, OK, all of your predictions were right, but they were right for the wrong reasons. I'll tell you, nobody on the trading floor would ever say that to anyone. Nobody on a trading floor would ever, even if it was true, you would never turn around to somebody and say, yes, you were right and I was wrong, but you were right for the wrong reasons and my fundamental arguments were right. You would never say that. And now, because in my heart of hearts, I'm a trader, I keep doing it. I keep going out and making predictions that nobody says are going to happen. You know, I put a video out 3 months ago saying asset prices will go through the roof. I've been saying consistently house prices will go through the roof. House prices are about to go through the roof. Almost every global stock market is at a new all-time high. The gold price has gone up like 30% since I made that video 3 months ago. I keep making these right predictions because I come from a world where that is enough to be listened to. But now I'm in this sort of cultural space where I keep making right predictions and people just don't listen, and it's quite frustrating. And I can't help but wonder why, one of the reasons why I don't get fronted. Listen, the BBC cannot afford my analysis. It cannot afford my analysis, right? My free market rate in one of them skyscrapers is £2 million a year. What is the price to get an analysis for me for one day? I don't know, 50 grand? The BBC cannot afford my analysis. But I can't help but wonder if the reason why I don't get fronted more is because of the way that I sound and the way that I look. And you wouldn't get that on the trading floor. You wouldn't get it at all.
Just to kind of problematize that a little bit, I think there is definitely a kind of endemic snobbery in the media and, yes, in the kind of left, like, discursive space. But there is also a very high tolerance for, as you say, being wrong consistently. I, like, find this so often. You're, like, going to a meeting with somebody who's just miscalled the election spectacularly and you'll have the polling results in front of you. And they have absolute tolerance for how wrong they were.
Yeah, I keep calling people out on WhatsApp groups. Somebody put on a WhatsApp group in sort of January. I don't know if you remember that the Labour Party is still insisting there's going to be an election in May. And it was like Feb or something that the Labour Party was like, there's definitely going to be an election in May. And they came out with that. And somebody put on one of these WhatsApp groups, there's definitely going to be an election in May. And I went and I looked at the betting markets. The betting market said it's about 20% chance an election in spring. And I said to her, okay, well, if you think that, why do you think the betting market's wrong? And she was like, oh, the betting market's always wrong. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to write down now what you said and we're going to come back in May and we're going to talk about it. Because I'm just frustrated with these people just making wrong predictions all the time and not getting called out on it. You know, I wrote an article for The Guardian in May 2020 saying house prices are going to go through the roof. And house prices are probably 15, 20% higher now. At the same time, Larry Elliott, chief economics correspondent for The Guardian, wrote an article saying house prices are going to collapse because of COVID. At this time, we were pumping hundreds of billions of pounds into the bank accounts of rich people. Nothing could have been more obvious than the rise in house prices. And yet, here's this guy saying they're going to collapse. You know, 4 years down the line, my predictions were all exactly right. His predictions were all completely wrong. Nobody even remembers. There's absolutely no checking of homework in this space. And it's so frustrating as somebody who has a very consistent track record of being right, tries very hard to be right, puts my own money on my prediction such that if I'm wrong, I will personally lose money. To see people with no skin in the game from very rich families just saying things are going to be fine. It's just absolutely maddening. While I make millions of pounds betting on the collapse of society, it's such an absurd situation to live in. I put at the end of my book in my acknowledgements, I would like to thank God or whoever it was who made it so easy to bet on terrible things and so difficult to stop them. Could just imagine what it's like to be me, right? I can walk into any one of these banks, get paid £1 million a year to bet on the collapse of society. I would work for the government for free. I would go on the BBC for free, and I do frequently go on the BBC for free, to say, listen, guys, society is going to collapse. Could we please stop it? And I can't do it. It's an absolutely absurd world that we have built where our best economists get paid millions of pounds to bet on collapse and have no way of even speaking about the collapse publicly. It's totally insane.
Our last question was going to be, have you changed your mind about anything, which I think was a polite way of saying, have you ever been wrong?
I mean, I've made trades that I've lost money on. You know, we've obviously got a trade in the book. One prediction that if you go back and watch my first video, How the Rich Get Rich from COVID-19, I said, when furlough scheme ends, unemployment will go through the roof. Because at the time I made that video, they were planning to end furlough before they end lockdown, which would have been a disaster. I probably could have predicted that they would extend furlough longer. I don't want to say I've never been wrong. You know, you've read the book. So what I do is, there's really everything I do and my whole career and all of my correct predictions are based on one specific thing. It's not that I am some sort of genius that understands the economy. What I understand is there is one massive black hole in understanding which causes constant mispredictions, which is nobody ever looks at the wealth distribution. So from the beginning of COVID, anyone who cared to look at it would have been like, oh my God, we are about to absolutely explode our wealth distribution. But nobody looked at it. And, you know, I wrote a piece, and in the end, IPPR did an analysis of the effect of lockdowns on wealth distribution on the back of my piece, but only because I pointed it out, right? This is destroying the economy. So really, it's quite easy. It's like if I knew somebody had cancer, but the doctors didn't think cancer existed. I would obviously be able to constantly outpredict them, right? Because I know that cancer has a pretty bad prognosis if untreated. That is exactly what's happening to our economy. Our economy has cancer and the doctors don't believe cancer exists. That is exactly what is happening. So they constantly mispredict from this. So really, I'm not a genius. I have just recognized one specific thing, which is massively important, which nobody ever talks about. That's all it is. And that is why I'm able to make these predictions. And that is why I could outpredict Larry Elliott, because I knew at the beginning of COVID that rich people were going to get like £1 million richer each. If you know that, of course house prices will go up. Of course stock prices will go up. Of course living standards will decrease. But nobody was talking about it at the time. I came to this conclusion in 2011. You know, you can read in my book the story of how I felt about realizing this was right. I'm convinced this was right. And, you know, because the thing with economics is it's not a science. You can't do experiments. All you can do is compete to be a correct predictor. And what I have seen is my understanding of the economy, which is that it is being killed by inequality, consistently outpredicts the mainstream analysis. And I think it's really frustrating that we don't have space in our public discourse for good predictors. Because otherwise, how else can you get a good economist? If you just let guys be wrong all the time and never challenge it, and you don't give the mic to people who are consistently right, how do you improve your economy? You know, so I'm not right on everything, but I'm very, very confident I'm right on this. If you do not stop inequality from exploding, living standards will collapse.